lot of Democratic schools won't even take a new student over the age of 12 or 13, because at that point it's kind of difficult to reverse the programming that they've had.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I'm the director of the Alternative Education Resource Organization. We just had our 15th anniversary, and we had a 15th anniversary conference. And the organization basically promotes educational alternatives, helps people who want to start new alternatives, helps people find alternatives for their kids or to teach in. And ultimately, our purpose is to try to make learner-centered education available to all children. Learner-centered education is an approach that is based on the interest of the student rather than curriculum-driven, where someone else has an idea of what it is you ought to be learning. Democratic education is education in which the students are actually empowered to make decisions about their own education, and if they're in a school, their own school. And there are varying degrees of power in democratic schools. In some cases, they can actually decide which staff are invited back the next year and so on. They have something to do with, they're on the committees for admissions. Everything that is decided goes through the democratic meeting. In other places, there are various restrictions, but in all cases, when they make the democratic decisions, those decisions stand. Those are the decisions. There are some schools that have a democratic meeting but still have compulsory class attendance. But there are many schools that have non-compulsory class attendance, and there is a little spectrum of those kinds of schools. On the one hand, you have Summerhill, one of the most famous ones, in which there is a set timetable of classes, but there's no pressure at all for the kids to go to them, and a lot of the kids don't go. But the ones who want to at least know they're going to be there, and they're going to be offered, and they can go. At the other end of that spectrum is Sudbury Valley School, which basically says that there are not going to be any classes unless a student actually asks for them. And then in the middle, there are the kinds of things that, for example, I did at my school, where anybody could offer a class, staff or student. There would be class announcements, and anything was considered to be a class. There was no set curriculum. And the students could choose to go or not to any of those that were announced, or decide to do something entirely different, or nothing.
Is there some kind of a conflict or contradiction in the idea of democratic schools?
I don't think it's an oxymoron, no. I think that children are natural learners, and it makes sense for a lot of kids to learn in a group, and you can call that a school, you can call it whatever you want. But I don't think there's an inherent contradiction. I think that what's happened is that the people who created the public school system, according to John Gatto, for example, actually had as their purpose not to create independent, strong thinkers who would be willing to stand up to the government and who would participate fully and completely in a democracy. In fact, I think they wanted to create, to kind of indoctrinate students into the kind of people that would be consumers, that would not rock the boat, that would know how to follow orders. I think that's what they got.
Maybe we can just talk a little bit about what does a school like that look like?
A democratic school? Well, they're generally small. I mean, Sudbury Valley is one of the bigger ones at about 200, 250 students. My school was never more than about 45. And so that's very small compared to the public schools. It's interesting that the Gates Foundation recently has come to realize that smallness is better, but to them, small school is 400. So, you know, they're moving in that direction. They're breaking up schools that have numbers like 3,000, 4,000 smaller units. But so they're moving in the right direction. But independent alternatives tend to be much smaller. And that in itself is a good thing because students are really thought of as individuals and not numbers. Then beyond that, they come about in various ways. For example, it could be started by a group of parents, could be started by students, could be started by teachers, and that has an effect on what kind of school it is. You know, it depends on where it's coming from. I found that, ironically, parent cooperatives don't seem to be that effective in the long run, and the most effective schools in the long run have been ones that were started by a leader with a vision, someone who had the ability to empower the students to be able to make decisions. It's ironic, and I think sometimes, you know, hopefully a school can evolve away from that somewhat, and it seems to have happened in a few cases, but it's very hard to make that transition. The free school in Albany is one which was founded by Mary Loya. She's not there anymore, and now the next generation of teachers is involved with running it, and so they sort of made a transition from their charismatic leader, founder. And that's also true of some Quaker schools, and I think they have the Quakerism as a kind of a base. One is called, for example, the Meeting School, which is in Ringe, New Hampshire, and another is Arthur Morgan School. They use the consensus model for making decisions. That Arthur Morgan School is a junior high school. They're both boarding, and that one is in North Carolina. What happens when groups of parents run a school without a clear leader, what often happens is that the parents are so invested in it that they kind of try to live vicariously through it, and it takes something away from the children's empowerment. And very often, because remember, you've got adults and who were not the products of the system that they espouse. A lot of democratic schools won't even take a new student over the age of 12 or 13, because at that point it's kind of difficult to reverse the programming that they've had. So if you take a bunch of adults that have not had that experience, I think you can run into trouble. And there's very often a lot of splintering, a lot of infighting, and so on. That's why it seems that you need a strong individual to take the leadership in order to really empower the students. I know this might be sound a little controversial to unschooling parents, but it's my experience. Mm-hmm. And for example, Summerhill School, believe it or not, is a proprietary school. It's actually owned by the Neal family. And Zoe, who runs the school now, it was her father who started the school in the 1920s, and he had her when he was 63 years old. So that's why she's still running it in her 50s, and she's had four children of her own go through the school. The youngest one, I think, just graduated, and now I think her grandchildren are starting to go. Mm-hmm. But she feels very strongly that if even it had been a nonprofit organization with a board, that they would have capitulated to the pressure from the government a long time ago to force compulsory classes and various other things at the school.
Maybe we can just talk about the advantages of democratic schools over unschooling, like a situation where the children are at home.
I ran a democratic school for 17 years. So for a long time, you know, I think other people who've done stuff like that couldn't imagine that all the wonderful benefits of the democratic process and the interaction and so on could be replicated in a homeschool situation. But I have changed my mind about that from my experiences subsequent to that, and I think that they all pretty well can work. Mm-hmm. And I think that a good homeschool, unschool situation could be is a great situation, because in those situations the kids are going to get plenty of interaction. They're going to be out in the world doing things. They're going to be interning. They're going to be joining any organizations they want to. And they are going to have in their own minds a very clear sense that they are the learner. So I think that that works fine. And in a good sort of, at my school, it was almost like a big unschool. in the sense that, it was totally learner-centered approach. So I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between them when you get to that level.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Iroquois democracy?
Oh, Iroquois democracy, yeah. Well, that's something that we evolved at my school. We started out with the typical sort of Roberts rules, tyranny of the majority approach, but we came into contact with the Mohawk Indians in our first year, and we visited them at their reservation at Akwesasne, which is in northern New York State. There are other reservations, too. People may not realize it, but the democracy that is practiced in the United States really got its inspiration from the Iroquois Confederacy, as Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin came in contact with them. Because what other model did they have before that? Royalty, you know. So it was interesting that in going back there, we discovered that when the Iroquois Confederacy was making decisions, if there was minority dissent, they didn't just go on from there, but they honored the minority by letting them say why they were voting the way they did, what their stand would be. And then there could be more discussion, and then it was somewhat incumbent upon that person or people to try to make a better proposal. And this could go on, this process could go on for a while. This is how we made decisions in our school. We discovered this in our relationship with the Mohawks and with the Iroquois and decided to do that. And it worked very, very well through all of our history, and so we have actually been trying to show other people how to do the same thing. And it's in practical terms, it's easy. What happens is once a proposal is voted on, you simply poll the minority, anybody who wants to say why they voted the way they did and against the proposal, and then anybody can ask for a revote with discussion. If nobody asks for that, then it just stands as it is. And if people vote the way they do and they don't feel like bringing anything further up, then they would be doing like what the Quakers call standing aside. They disagree, but they're willing to try it out. I'll give you an example of this. I went to something called the HES Fest, the Home Education Seaside Festival in England. This is where something like 1,000 homeschoolers camp out for a week by the sea. And I was there to demonstrate democratic process. It's interesting. I first started out, I went into it was in a big tent. And there were, as were most of the workshops there, presentations, about a couple hundred parents, or adults rather, or whatever, and maybe a smattering of kids. Mm-hmm. I had actually gotten about 10 kids to come in and volunteer to kind of fishbowl this demonstration. Mm-hmm. So we got in the middle and we started talking about it, and we said, you can put whatever you want on the agenda. And so they put on the agenda squirt guns, because it had become an issue, who could use them, when, where, and who was objecting to them, and Pokemon cards. Mm-hmm. At that point, a few of the kids left, and I thought, it was still okay, we can start discussing it. So we started discussing the squirt guns, and then the kids who left came back with, like, all the rest of the kids. They said, you won't believe this, they're actually talking about something that's important to discuss. And in the discussion about squirt guns, it was the proposal first was passed that the squirt guns could only be used in a certain field, one field. But when we asked the people who voted against it why they did, one of them said, my children are young and they're pretty far away from that field. I really don't want them to be wandering that far away. Another person said, well, I live in that field. That's where my tent is. I don't want that to be the only place. And then someone else said, well, there's no water tap in that field. So we had a revote, and it was reversed. And it was a very instructive thing to everyone to realize that, that this was not set in stone, that it was a real discussion, and reversal and change was possible. I think people sometimes have the idea from voting in our general elections that everything is sort of predetermined and what they say doesn't matter. So this was enlightening to people. And then what happened a few days later was kind of interesting. The kids afterwards decided they wanted to have more meetings, and I didn't know if there would actually be anything. And then at one point I was in the campground there, and it was sort of a big campground. And there was a sweet store, you know, a little store in the campground. And what had happened was that I guess someone had shoplifted. Kid had shoplifted something in that store, and so the woman was now refusing to let any children go into the store. And so the kids were very upset, and they wanted to have a meeting about this. So we kind of put it on the board and let the word spread. We didn't know if anybody would even show up to this meeting. Well, when the meeting happened, there were about 200 kids there and maybe 25 parents. And we had the discussion. And by the way, one of the key things in this that really worked well with such a large group in the democratic process is we had a portable microphone so that even the quietest kid could be heard, you see. And it worked very well that way. You raise your hand, you get the microphones brought to you, and you speak. Well, you know, we had some discussion about it, and people were saying, you know, we should go tell her that this was discrimination and so on. Well, you know, we had some discussion about it, and people were saying, you know, we should go tell her that this was discrimination and so on. And there was a woman sitting there who had come to the meeting, and her six-year-old was sitting on her lap. And then his hand went up, and we brought the mic to her. You could see her expression, you know, it was like, oh, my God, what's he going to say? And the six-year-old said, I think that the woman in the shop is under a lot of stress and pressure. It's difficult to watch so many kids at once. And I think we could offer to help her out, but I don't think that's the most important thing. I think we need to apologize to her, and I make that a proposal. So everybody was stunned, including the kid's mother, and we discussed it, and it was passed. Afterwards, about a dozen of us got together who were going to go down. We tried, well, who's going to represent us? And we thought, well, it should be Alfie, the six-year-old. So, and his mother decided not to go with him. She wanted him to go on his own. And so the group of us went down there. I introduced him to the woman at the sweet shop and explained to her what we had just done, the meeting, and he spoke to her in the most beautiful way. And that was it. She totally melted. From then, and all the kids were able to come to the sweet shop.
Is democratic education accessible to most people?
One of our main thrusts has been to help people set up homeschool resource centers, where you're homeschooling and you take the basic responsibility for your child's education, but you do it in a group. You hire resource people if you want. Those parents who are free can go in and do it. And so this way, people who are working parents can homeschool or unschool. Or there's another approach, and this is one of the very first homeschool resource centers I ever saw. This was in Paris back around 1989. I saw the Collectif Enfants Parents, and they met every day in a different house with about 15 kids, and each family got a half a day off of work per parent a week, and there were two parents on at any time, and that way they covered the whole week, a half a day each. And the kids were the real continuity. And they've been doing it for 15 years. I think that these things don't have to be institutions. They serve a purpose. I worked with a group here on Long Island for a while, and they swore they could never homeschool. They wanted to see a school started, and eventually they realized it wasn't going to happen. And so they rented a little space, and they meet now twice a week. And the parents go in and work with the kids there. It can be done, you know, in various ways. Also, of course, homeschooling doesn't have to be done certain hours. I know one woman that I did a consultation for who was so desperate that she got a babysitter. She was working, and both her and her husband were working, but she got a babysitter for a kid during the day, and she worked with him in the evenings and weekends, and the kid was perfectly happy with that.
Take good care of each other. That's what friends like to do. Let your sister and brother help you learn that it's true. We all need to feel wanted for the people who we are. So take good care.
Take good care.
Take good care of each other. Oh, take good care of each other. That's what friends like to do. Let your sister and brother help you learn that it's true. We all need to feel wanted for the people who we are. So take good care.
Take care.
Take good care.
Take good care.
Take good care of each other.
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
I knew John Holt quite well. I remember having a discussion with him about Christian homeschoolers and the fact that a lot of them do school at home. And he felt that eventually the kids would teach their parents how to teach them, or they'd get frustrated and give up and send their kids to Christian schools. And in fact, it seems that there has been an evolution in Christian education. And there are a lot of Christian educators that call themselves unschoolers now. So I think that the parents do learn from the kids, and I think they realize that the kids bring the curriculum with them, and it's the parents' job to listen well to what the kids say that they're interested in or show that they're interested in. It isn't always verbal. And that's really where it becomes an art, and I don't necessarily agree with people who say you can't do anything until the kid says they're interested. If you know your child and you can see what kinds of things that they are likely to be interested in, I don't see any problem, and I do not think that it is inconsistent with the idea of unschooling to present certain ideas and possibilities.
How about academics, though? Do you think in the democratic education, often the schools don't focus so much on academics? There's a debate about whether or not we should continue having the free hours.
Well, I mean, it really depends on what you think is basic. It's interesting. If you talk about the real basics, I think one of the most basic things that kids need to learn is how to get along with other people in life. And I think that homeschoolers actually manage to do that better than public school kids. When you talk about socialization, they can't even look an adult in the eye, kids in the public schools. They're not part of their world. They also can't seem to relate to many people beyond that one little age range that they're stuck in. They don't have that experience, whereas homeschoolers, because their parents bring them with them everywhere, they get to relate to kids and adults of all ages. And so that's one of the most important basics, you see. Another basic is to be able to find the answers to your own questions. In this age, it really doesn't matter what you specifically know. Albert Einstein was once asked what the speed of sound was, and he says, I don't bother memorizing things that I can look up. The fact is that the least important thing today is what facts you've memorized, because with the information explosion, you could never learn a millionth, a billionth of what there is out there. What's important is that you know how to answer the questions that you have and find those resources. So those are the real basics. And the whole idea, this emphasis on high-stakes tests and these standardized tests, are exactly antithetical to that concept. We're starting a new school this year in Brooklyn, and it's interesting. We had a meeting this last weekend of the students and the teachers, and we had a meeting with the kids to discuss whether they thought that there was somebody there advocating for this sort of Sudbury Valley approach of no classes offered unless kids ask for them. And unanimously, the kids rejected that. They were perfectly happy to have somebody offer things to them, and they didn't feel that they were so demoralized that they would have to follow it. So I think that this will be the first democratic school in New York City in decades.
So the history of these democratic schools, how recent is it?
Well, you can go pretty far back. You know, there was once a guy by the name of Bronson Alcott who had a little school in the 1800s, 1830 or so, and then he decided to accept a black girl into his school, and pretty soon he only had six kids left in his school, but one of them was his daughter, Louisa May Alcott. And so that's where she got a lot of her inspiration for the books Little Men and Little Women. It goes back pretty far, but I think that one of the key events was when the school Summerhill started in the 1920s, and another key event was when the book Summerhill was published in the United States in 1960. That started the free school movement, which then led to the alternative school movement, which then led to homeschooling, charter schools, and all that. And the idea of recreation and education combining is all kind of together. I think the thing to know is that this is an international phenomenon, that this is going on all over the world, this education revolution. By the way, it's a good segue for people to know that they can find information about us from our website, which is educationrevolution.org. We do have an 800 number that people can call us at. I think they can call us from that number in Canada, too. It's 800-769-4171. 800-769-4171. If you go to the website, educationrevolution.org, you can actually write to me from that site, too. Now, as far as the international aspect of it, we started something called the International Democratic Education Conference back in 1993 in Israel. And we've now met every year since then. In 1993, we hosted the last IDEC for the first time in the United States. It was in Troy, New York. We had 500 people come, maybe more than that, from 25 countries and 25 states. We raised $60,000 so that low-income and third-world people could participate. So we had people from India, Nepal, Thailand, Russia, Ukraine, Guatemala, Hungary, Poland, etc. It was an amazing, amazing event. It'll probably never be duplicated again, and we had 17 keynote speakers, none of whom charged us, and one of them was Zoe Redhead, A.S. Neal's daughter from Summerhill, and one of them was John Gatto, Pat Montgomery from Clonlara, and just on down the line, just an amazing group of people. We have a MP3 recording of all those keynotes, by the way. If people are interested, they can actually order it from our site. There are democratic schools, various kinds of alternative schools, homeschool movements all over the world. There are, for example, in Israel, where we started that IDEC, there was a school that I visited back then called the Democratic School of Hadera. It had 300 kids in it at that time and 3,000 on the waiting list. Now there are 25 more democratic schools in Israel, and the person who's organizing them is Yaakov Hecht, who is now going to be going to New Zealand to do something similar and is trying to start institutes of democratic education around the world. They have a training program for people who are going to teach in democratic schools and so on. So that's just one kind of thing that's going on. I know of a school called the School of Self-Determination that has 1,200 students. It's a big school, public school, inner city public school. In that school, the kids have the constitutional right to leave any class they want without explanation. When a teacher wants to teach there, they do a test class, and the students vote on who is to be hired. This is in Moscow. So that's just a little smattering of an example of what's going on around the world. The next IDEC, by the way, next International Democratic Education Conference, is going to be this December in India, from the 3rd to the 10th of December. This is happening everywhere. The homeschool movement is growing by leaps and bounds in England, and the HESFest is just one example of it. I think it's important for people to network. It's one reason for them to kind of join our organization, because they can, you know, homeschoolers and alternative school people are communicating all over the world.
The more we get together, 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 the more we get together, the happier we'll be. 'Cause your friends are my friends, and my friends are your friends. The more we get together, the happier we'll be. Oh, the more we get together, 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 the more we get together, the happier we'll be. There's Chris and Tanya and Jason and Justin. The more we get together, the happier we'll be. Okay, are you ready to sing now? The more we get together, 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 the more we get together, the happier we'll be. 'Cause your friends are my friends, and my friends are your friends. The more we get together, the happier.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L 8S1CO.